Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 162, Deepening Wisdom and Compassion.
Has two meanings in English, and lots of sub-meanings, but two main meanings. And one is the reason I like to say two realities about this particular set of concepts is that truth can mean, it's like a proposition, you know, like a statement, a phrase, you know, a truth. And it isn't that meaning of truth. Truth can also mean reality. You know, like the truth of a situation, the truth of the world, you know. And that's like the objective thing. And the word that is translated as the two satyas, the word satya in Sanskrit, sat means to be, it's the verb to be. So satya means what is, you know, what is there. So, and the four noble truths are also called satya. And you can even translate those as facts. You can call them realities. You know, the reason they translated them as truths all the time is that they wanted Buddhism, since they were saying it was a religion, they wanted it to have some creed, something you had to believe. But the Four Noble Truths is not something you're supposed to believe. You're supposed to recognize the suffering, you're supposed to understand the cause, you're supposed to realize the nirvana, and you're supposed to learn the Eightfold Path, you know, the Fourth Noble Truth. So they're sort of a different category than a creed. You know, it's not something just to be believed. But anyway, never mind. We'll just call them the truth. That's what they call them in the book. So these two truths are... So non-duality, in other words, this is what is a little bit subtle about it. Non-duality, the fact that, you know, nirvana is the one reality that's really real. But the unreally real is also still somewhat real. Meaning, and if you see, when you look at it, when you're in a movie theater and you see Avatar and you see the Navi people struggling with the Marines, you know, and the corporation trying to extract the element that he was trying to extract out of the planet, out of the moon there, remember the Avatar? I bet nobody remembers the name of that element, just to know what a genius James Cameron is. It's called unobtainium. I love James Cameron. Anyway, I'm just saying, when you see that, that's an illusion. Of course, there are no Navi, and there's no like banshee on the moon of Jupiter, as far as we know. So it's a complete illusion. But it has a reality, right? You get into the, and you're rooting for them, and I was rooting for Sigourney Weaver to switch bodies in time and everything, etc. So there's an illusory reality, in other words. And the superficial or relative reality is an illusory reality in the sense that it seems to be something that it isn't. But it's not totally non-existent, is the point, right? So the two truths issue has to do with what he calls deceptive truths, which is based on the Tibetan translation of a word in Sanskrit called samvrti, which literally means, it might be easier for you to understand if you went back to that word, it's superficial. So there's the superficial truth, and then there's the profound truth, the ultimate truth, you know? And like, you know, that's the way things are. Like, we sort of see the surface of something, and it has a reality on the level of that surface reality. And then what is covered over by that surface reality is the real reality of the thing. You know, that sort of fits in our mind, that little easier than deceptive. But deceptive is not wrong, it's absolutely okay. So he gives the two kinds of two truths here, which Shantideva does right away when he starts it on wisdom. that there are deceptive truths and ultimate truths. And the ultimate truths are so called because they are truths comprehended, I'm on page 149, truths apprehended by a superior, so this is a silly translation, it means a noble one. I don't like calling it superior, but a noble one. Anyway, that wisdom to which no deceptive truths appear. And this is kind of indicating that when you seek the nature of things and you come up on the pure negation of emptiness, then you will have an understanding where the things will disappear. So it's like the moment where when you first look at a mirror reflection, and at first you think you're looking through a window into a three-dimensional space, and then the moment where you discover that the room that seemed to be on the other side of the mirror slash window, misapprehended as a window, is not there. In a way, that three-dimensional room disappears. And so that's what he means by the ultimate truth. There's an experience which involves critical insight combined with very sharp and stable concentration, where the equivalent of the 3D room that you see through the mirror, you realize it's not there, so it disappears, actually. But it actually leaves the reflection on the surface of the mirror, doesn't it? But your mind cognizes the lack of the 3D room beyond the mirror. So what happens is a brilliant lama I once had who passed away, a former life, and he said, our sense of relationality and perceiving relative objects, including ourselves as a relative object, because all we've ever been is a relative object, ourself. We have a relative self, and it's always been relative. But when we look for it, when we acknowledge that we have a distortion known as ignorance or delusion or naivete, if you're really creative, we think that self is an absolute thing. It's really objectively there, sort of, as a fixed thing, you know, that it's always us. And when it's been so, our relative perceptions of ourselves have been so entwined with an erroneous assumption that the core of them, there's a fixed self, that when we first discover the absence of the fixed self, it seems to take our relative perceptions with it. Do you follow me? Because they've been so long entwined with each other. And we have an experience of a sort of an empty space. And unfortunately, even the way it's phrased in this translation, which I wouldn't accuse Shantideva of, it almost seems like the empty space, which is like the absence of what you're looking for, as if it were something, do you follow? Is something. And that's the real thing. But the key point is that when you have that meditative experience, it's very good to have this very clear up ahead of time. When you have that meditative experience, if you ever do, if we do, and you can have little versions of it without being the king of the May, you know, or queen of the May. And when you have that experience, the disappeared experience also disappears. That's the last step. There's a further step, in other words. In other words, they call that state of disappearance when you're looking for the real self or the real substance of the pillar or the floor or something, and then you meditatively have this inner concentration, like this inner mental sensory consciousness that sees through the object, it analyzes it and dissolves it into nothing, not seemingly nothing. But then that's called space-like equipoised concentration. And it's an experience like space. But then the momentum of this analytic, critical, probing, what they call ultimacy-seeking rational cognition in the Tibetan technicalities. You know, ultimate reality-seeking rational cognition, combined with one-pointed meditative concentration. But it's momentum, even though you're no longer a sort of, you have a sense of release in this space, but there's kind of a momentum anyway. And the momentum is, although you don't feel you have a body when you reach that, You don't have a sense of language. So it's just momentum. But that momentum kind of wants to assess the reality of the space state itself. And then what that happens with that is, was there a former moment when I wasn't in the space? Was there a boundary when I got into the space? In the space, is there an up, down, north, south, earlier or later? Do you follow me? Like sort of probing to see is the space state real? But it's an odd one because there's no person there probing it. It's just a momentum. But then what happens is that you transit, and sometimes this can take longer and shorter, into what's called dreamlike or illusion-like aftermath samadhi. In other words, things reappear. You reappear. And you, wow, you know, you had a released feeling of great release, of great vastness. But things are back. And it's like when you're looking in the mirror is the best analogy. But of course, no analogy is perfect, but it's really the best. That's why one of the most important tantric wisdoms is called the mirror-like wisdom. So just like you discovered when you were looking through the window of the mirror into a 3D room beyond the mirror, you discovered that's not there. And you have a momentary sense of disappearing or something. But then you see, you then reassess, you return to the perception where it still looks like there's things beyond the mirror and through the window. But now you mentally correct and you know it's a reflection on the surface of the mirror. You follow? Because of the experience you had where you realize you put your hand to go reach through the, when you tried to shatter the glass and reach into your face as reflected in the mirror, and all you did was hit the mirror. So that's an experience of the non-existence of that space, which then is replaced by still seeing it, but now you know it's an illusion. Do you follow? Isn't it neat? That's right, neat. And then, because the first experience of that will be quite dramatic in how it affects the way you live, but yet it won't usually be, anyway, complete experience of it. Because the complete experience of it is where you experience the world as if it were not there, if it were pure space, which was blissful, the release into that was a blissful feeling, and you maintain that blissful feeling of freedom from being bound in any particular perspective or location or whatever it is in this space, at the same time as being able to inhabit your particular position in it and deal with its differentiations. And so there's in one kind of procedure, there's an oscillation between having this space like equipoise samadhis and then dream-like aftermath or illusion-like aftermath samadhis. And going back and forth, and then after you're back in the aftermath samadhi and you're realizing it's illusion-like, and then after a while you get where you kind of forget that it will disappear when you really investigate it, and it has a false way of presenting itself, and you'll forget that and you'll get all tangled up in it again, then you go back and meditate and it'll disappear again, and then it'll go deeper, and then you go back and forth, in other words, right? But very key, this is why learning, wisdom born of learning, is essential to develop wisdom born of critical reflection and wisdom born of meditation. Because otherwise, when you have that first space-like equipoise samadhi experience, you will think you reached the absolute, and then you will go around dragging that experience of the absolute around you. In Zen, it's called, you'll be imprisoned in the demon ghost cave of thinking there's a real emptiness somewhere that you found, so you're better than other people who don't know it, and they just think they're here in this differentiated world. But you're out of it temporarily and still in a real world. But you're so much better because you're going to go back to it. So you're so cool. And you can go around like certain people who we've all had experience of lately, who just act like idiots because they say, well, I realize emptiness, so I can do whatever I feel like. Which is totally stupid, actually. It's the misapprehension of that experience as thinking that touched the ultimate. And even when you talk about the two truths like this, like there's a truth out there. You see, the fact of there being two of them is part of the relative deceptive truth. There's actually only one of them. But it contains both of them. You follow me? It's really, it's very subtle and very easy, really. But of course, it's the kind of thing that's hard to remember. It's like you look in the mirror. But We do it. When you look in the mirror in the morning to put on your, you know, eyebrow thing or whatever, lipstick or man's shame or whatever, or men distressed, see they're getting old and falling apart, like women do, everyone does. When you do that, you don't stop to think, oh, there's no other person in here with left, right, reverse to me. This is just a mirror reflection. You don't need to. But because that underlying intuition, based on your past experience, that this is just a reflection on the surface of a mirror, is just still, it's still there. It's held there. You don't have to think about it. But it's obviously combined indivisibly with your looking at what the details of the mirror. You're just there like doing whatever you're doing. Right? And you know it's a reflection, but you don't think, oh, this is just a reflection of the mirror. Right? So enlightened state is a kind of paradox or dichotomy reconciling state of awareness, like our awareness when we look in a mirror. So we're capable of that even unenlightened. You know, we're not yet Buddhas, but we are capable of holding two opposite things simultaneously in mind, at sort of different levels of mind. And if we analytically say it can be different levels, but they're full experiential things, really. And one doesn't require further thought, because it's very concrete. That intuition. That's why I really like to use intuition for, it has it in English, for this sort of deep, what in the old days I used to also use in people, very high scholastic snobs, they call gnosis.
Okay.
Which is gnose, you know. And then they even have an expression, in French I especially love it, le gnosiologie. Le gnosiologie de la texte. Oh, they love that. Gnosiology, it sounds like some weird kind of like two-legged elephant or something. You know, it has a long nose, you know, the gnosiology. Anyway, never mind. So these are the two, but therefore, right away, in a way, the kindness of Buddha's teaching and of these great philosophers, by putting right away, there are these two realities. So they're not negating our relative reality at all by the discovery that there's a transcendent way of dealing with it, where it's a bliss to be engaged with it rather than a hassle. Do you follow? Because when you're on the deceptive level with your deceptive mind, it's a hassle. And also yesterday in the other book, Solis was going on about suffering and that, you know, the suffering of the gods. Remember, he lightly touched on that in that other text. Remember, and suffer, of course, health and pretas and animals. The chigla chiksa, the one eating another, suffering of the animal's kingdom. And, you know, the point of that is to, the more we realize that there is a way of relating to it all based on the freedom of emptiness that His Holiness is so ecstatic about, so beautifully, because He really has understood something, of course, way beyond. But because, you know, within that, then to keep motivating ourselves to deepen that way of relating, the wisdom, compassion way of relating, it's good the more we can be opening, acknowledging to ourselves the hassle of the other part, you know, the deceptive part. Because, you know, we're always trying to make the best of the deceptive part. And this is one thing that we're, you know, the smile thing he was going, we have to be encouraged. We have to acknowledge that we are brainwashed by our cultural conditioning, which is not just a Western one, actually. It was like that in Vedic India. It still is like that in Vedic India. It was like that in China. Still is in sort of post-Confucian Mao, Xi Jinping China. Everyone is massively put down from a young age. Oh, you can't expect that much out of life. Oh, it's a big problem. Oh, etc. So you'd be resigned. It's going to be basically miserable. But make the best of it and say, I'm fine, when someone asks, how are you? Oh, I'm great, even, you know, you're supposed to say. And you would say, actually, you have a very pain in your knee and your foot and you're like worried about something and whatever, and someone's having a freak out back at home and you can't get on the internet to talk about it. So we're conditioned to not expect anything much out of it, actually. And therefore, we're in denial about the obvious drawbacks of being, of living with ordinary biases and living in an unrealistic and deceived way. And therefore, we don't have a strong motive to, we lessen our motive to escape from it, which we can do. Right? That's a really important thing. You know? And And all of the, you know, all of the cultures, all human cultures are pretty much like that, actually. Not just Western ones. Eastern ones, too. The big authoritarian thing. And the Tibetans were conquering everybody and beating them all up. They were very, very tough, you know, before the Dharma came up with its smile. The Buddha holding the smile. You know, they were not smiling before that. And the people, their neighbors, were not smiling. They were really tough people. Okay, that was something I wanted to tell you all as you were going over that. So now, two types of persons. And here he goes, this, whoever this translator is constantly, everything has to be superior, which is so hierarchical in the language, I don't like it. This word, superior insight, I translate as transcendent insight. It's an insight through which you transcend like a distorted way of experiencing things. And in that sense, you go beyond them. It isn't superior in the sense of you're better than someone else. You know, it's like, I hate that, constantly doing that. Calm abiding, that means one-pointed concentration. And common people, and then again, remember I already told you about this, and common people means alienated individuals who are not so endowed with the concentration, meaning they've developed, cultivated this type of samadhi, you know, vipassana samadhi, that means, you know, the combination of vipassana and shamatha.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series Pilgrimage, using classic field recordings from the Dosset tours of Robert Thurman and the Tibet House membership community to elucidate basic ideas and concepts of the tradition. Watch classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered and rendered as educational videos on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Every view, like, comment, and subscription helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And now back to Bob. In the second half of this week's podcast.
So they even say that, you know, if you develop the combination of shamatha and vipassana, that what happened? If you develop the combination of them, then that's like another kind of sense organ, you know, like a different kind of eye. It's a mental eye, E-Y-E, that can see, you know, freedom. That experiences freedom, like you can see the table or something, you know. It's you create a new organism in a way. They have a wonderful thing like that. In the Abhidharma, yogis have a thing where they analogize different mental abilities as if they were different organisms, as if your organism expanded, you had a different mind. I had a friend actually who was a mathematician who said that mathematics created another brain, you know. An interesting way of talking about it. Okay, so yogis, and that's what yogi means, you know. Because yogi means, the really deep meaning of yogi means one who harnesses their worldview to their life force. So, and the world, realistic worldview, meaning the worldview of freedom. The worldview that reality actually is bliss, freedom, indivisible. And they harness their life force to that. That's the real meaning of yogi. And that can mean developing your body as a better instrument of experiencing things by removing its inner denials and locks and fears and armorings and traumas, you know, crystallized traumas into muscular neural locks and things like that. It can be physical like that, but it's also mental. And then mental connects ultimately to the neurology through the chakra system back to physical. So finally mind and body become one thing. But yogi means both of those. You know, Raja Yoga is mind yoga kind of. Anyway, okay, contradict these views with reasoning such as the body is not a unit because it has many parts. With that you can easily understand, right? And the mind is not permanent because it changes into something else. Those are sort of very preliminary things, okay? Now, there's all there's actually an error here. There's a typo. He is calling the Chittamatrans proponents of external existence, but actually they are the proponents of the absence of external existence. Chittamatran in Sanskrit means mind only. So I'm sorry, there are a little few typos in here. And the proponent, they consider other people proponents of it. Oh, well, maybe he means this as a different people. I'm sorry, it's a list. Okay, right, thank goodness. Okay, not a typo. These are what are called the realists, usually. The only people who call them proponents of external existence are the Chittamatrans, but this is not the Chittamatrans. I take it back. I made a mistake. These are the realists, and those are the two Theravada philosophical views and schools, you know, of the Theravada Buddhism or the Theravada and Mahasanghika Buddhism, individual vehicle Buddhism. But nobody calls them that. They're called the realists, Lovermala, or substantialists. They're called, because they think there's a real nirvana and a real samsara, and the two are different. So they're epistemological realists, if you don't mind such a horrible sounding word. And the one who called them proponents of external existence are the Chittamatrans, who are idealists, who we could call simply idealists. That is to say, they say that everything is made of mental. And our perception of the external world, therefore, is where the illusion lies. And the whole world is in our mind. That's their view. And many people think that's the view of all Buddhism. And maybe this person also thinks so. But that's wrong. Because the Madhyamikas, which just simply means the centrist. Everybody likes to use their name, their Sanskrit name, Madhyamika, which I was cured of in a class of mine about 30 years ago, when one wit among my students said, "Oh, what about that Jewish, weird Jewish sect you were telling us about, the Madhyamikas?" So I decided we didn't need to inflict that word on everybody all the time. And the reason people do that is that they don't like to say middleist. Sounds so like something, because everybody has to say middle way. But you know what? We can easily say centrist, because the word Madhyama means center also. It doesn't have to be middle. And so you can say centrist. So idealist and centrist. So actually these three things, the easier would be, and less confusing to you if you call them the realists, the idealists, and the centrists. You know, which someday people won't mind doing. And these are the yogis, meaning the people who are, basically they mean philosophers, who are developed as Buddhist philosophy, is critical philosophy, critiquing the, you know, ordinary person's notion that the world is just what it seems to be at different levels. And the realists also critique the sort of seeming surface appearance of things, in that they say there's an essence, a solid essence in the thing. They're like Plato. And okay, he was a mixture of idealists and realists, but he said that the concept tableness was the essence of every single table. So that the fact that the real thing was the concept tableness, pure form of tableness, made him a bit of an idealist, but that he thought that that was in every solid thing made him a little bit of a realist, something like that. Plato was. But the realists are like that. Then the idealists are the ones who push that more, and they say, well, it's really the idea of the thing in my mind that then creates the perception of the seemingly external table, and then they withdraw from the external table. And it's actually a very deep and wonderful view. It's also Deepak's view, used to be. I think I'm helping him go beyond it. But it's a Vedantic view, but it's a good view in the Mahayana sense, because it helps a person become a bodhisattva. Because it's easier to think, I'm going to change the whole world and all the state of all the other beings by changing myself to become a Buddha. Because since, in a way, the whole world is created by my mind's distortion, when my mind is accurately reflecting things, this will automatically affect everyone else. And therefore, if the world is just a reflection of what's in your mind, the mind seems less substantial, like made of concrete, and you can change it. So then you can change the world. You get a messianic attitude more easily, because you feel, I can change the world. Sure, because I can change my mind. So it actually gives a kind of courage to the proto-bodhisattva, the would-be bodhisattva, that they can change the world, to be an idealist. And Asanga and Maitreya, who seemed to have founded the Chittamatran or the idealistic mind-only school, are known as the magnificent deed lineage or the vast deed lineage of Mahayana. However, then the centrist comes along and pops that bubble, unfortunately, and reestablishes external things and says, you know, you cannot say it's all just mind, because there's other minds outside you. So it's an intersubjective mind field, and it's more convenient within that to consider external objects, although illusory, to be external, because otherwise your danger is that you will project your absolutism, your sense that things are absolutely what they seem to be, into your interior world. And that's sort of a little more murky and hard to find, is your feeling of an internal absoluteness. And so you'll get stuck in some sort of inner world of experience. And that's their critique of the mind-only people. Okay, and so I think the best expression for the centrist is that they're relativists. But relativists in modern philosophy has a very bad reputation in ethics and so forth. It's a situationalist, and they have all kind of things acting like they're just sort of dealing with things ad hoc, you know. Because Western people are, and basically everybody, wants to have absolute principles to guide themselves by. Because they feel they have to follow some rules, you know. And they don't realize that compassion is the absolute. And therefore, the positive kind of hedonism, meaning the best feeling, the best outcome of good feeling, of well-being among everyone, is the absolute best thing. And therefore, you have to be situational. You have to adapt to specific relational situations. They feel nervous without absolute rules, so they think relativism is bad. But actually, relativism... or relativityism is Buddha's view, actually, rather than being stuck in some absolute theory or philosophy or something. All philosophy, all description of relative world is relative. There's no ultimate dogmas. Except that. Negation. And that's a negation. Right? So... then this is very good. There are differences in their understanding of the nature of knowable entities. And the two realities are the different kinds of knowable entities. That's how they're defined, as things that can be known, either by a distorted consciousness or by an accurate consciousness. Thereby, those with higher views progressively contradict those with lower views. That is to say, more simplistic and more sophisticated. It's so beautiful, actually. It really is beautiful. The curricula of the great Buddhist universities are so magnificent, beautiful. Like the way they teach history of philosophy and the way they teach philosophy is that, and they even say, don't try to be a centrist. Don't try to be an idealist. Be a good realist. If you go beyond realist, you feel that you're skirting nihilism. You're going to become careless about causality. You won't understand how causality can be binding in a way as a relative thing. If it's not absolute to you, if it doesn't have some vestige of absoluteness, you're going to become crazy. You're going to become impulsive, just follow your impulse, because you will think that it doesn't matter, because you're going to denigrate, repudiate, deprecate causality and responsibility and consequentiality. So stay with whatever level of philosophy you feel coherent. You follow me? Because philosophy is like therapy. It's worldview therapy. And worldview is critical to how you live. Your view determines, show me. I think there's a famous thing in Western mysticism, hermeticism, called Hermes Trismegistus. Show me your beginning and I'll show you your end. It's what is your presupposition, and that's where you'll end up. So the whole curriculum has to do with kind of a hierarchy of openness of your central nervous system, actually. Openness of your heart. Openness of your love and compassion. And you should have a view that fits sort of with what you're able to cope with. And if you can't cope with being wide open, don't try to adopt some wide open philosophy, because it will turn into nihilism. You'll think, no, be here now, let it all go, like drop out, little hang out, like whatever. You'll get like that, and you'll become irresponsible and troublesome and harmful to yourself and others. So it isn't like everybody has to adopt the view. The ultimate view is the no-view view. But that's hard to do without becoming nihilistic. And it goes along with it fits therapeutically with your neurology. That's what's so fantastic about it. It's like my natural science colleagues, who we all love, and as long as listens to them, how brilliant they are, endlessly. I'll sit there and listen to them. Hour after hour, his secretaries get all upset about it. And they want him to meet people, politicians and save Tibet. And he listens to hours and hours. Because he loves them, because they have a principle that they're supposed to be attending to real experience without denial. But they're not trained in philosophy, because they think they don't need philosophy. That's the humanities. That's like soft power, Meanwhile, the materialist theory is a philosophical theory. It is not a discovery. The idea that there's only matter in the universe, nobody discovered that. They didn't find out the no other thing outside of the matter that they then say isn't there. And they didn't find its absence either, because you don't find nothing. Nobody can find it. But they think it's a discovery, and they don't have to learn to be critical about the way they project their biases. So they're not trained in philosophy. Meanwhile, they are the ultimate. Remember, natural science used to be natural philosophy. Do you remember that? So it's a branch of philosophy. And all the only people in America nowadays, in the West, in England or America, who are known as well-known philosophers, they've been doing for a century. They're announcing the death of philosophy. That's all they do. And they say we should be art critics or social critics or journalists. And that's what we're doing as philosophers. Or we're teaching people pre-law how to debate rhetoric. And they don't think it's a scientific thing. There's book after book about how, we don't do metaphysics anymore. Metaphysics used to mean that which you needed to do in order to, it means that which is theories of what is real. So then that guides your research into what is real. And you have to develop that as a thing. And they lost that. And the only philosophers I know who are happy as philosophers are the ones who have rediscovered Buddhist philosophy, actually. Believe it or not. and some who discovered a Hindu, because the Hindu is resonates off the Buddhist one, actually. But most powerfully the Buddhist one, because the Hindu then closes down in various kinds of theism. But the Buddhist one takes you right to shunyata, takes you to the happy smile and his holiness. It does. But totally logically, who was saying about logic? Oh, you would say, yeah, totally logically. The logic is intense. If anybody remembers Walden, did anybody ever read Thoreau? I don't know if you remember, but at the end of Thoreau, there's this thing about, because he was reading Vishnu Purana and these kind of Hindu things, and as well, he also did some Buddhist things, but he was reading them. And there was this guy who wants to make a walking stick, and the most amazing walking stick in the universe, and give it to someone he loves or something. And he goes and he spends like 2 aeons finding the best deodar pine in the Himalayas. Then he spends another 2 aeons carving it and 10 aeons doing this. And finally he has this ultimate walking stick. And then he's in another universe and he doesn't know where a person is to give it to them. And so he has an amazing thing like that. He gets into that Indian idea of timelessness. Thoreau does. Okay, anyway, I'm sorry, that's a digression, I know. So he says, if no deceived consciousnesses exist, the mind-only guy says, then what mind can refer to the illusion like appearances? Because the Chittamatran, the idealist, still at a subtle level, has to feel that there's something real about the mind. The mind cannot be truthless. You know, one synonym of emptiness is truthlessness, by the way. And that means, so the ultimate truth is truthlessness, in other words. Right? There's your ultimate anti-dogmatic sort of strong formulation. It's the negation, you know? And then, truth habit the truth habit is a synonym at this subtle epistemological and psychological level of self-habit or identity habit. A reality habit or objectivity habit. They're so sophisticated in this level, which is both a neurological level and a philosophical level. So the Chittamatran feels, well, if there's no mind, then how do I attain nirvana? You know, it's my mind that becomes nirvana, you know, so it has to be something true about my mind. So he's arguing, if no deceived consciousnesses exist, then what mind can refer to the illusion-like experience? So what is the non-illusory one that knows that it's illusory, in other words, he's saying. And then the Madhyamaka says, if illusion-like external objects are not real for you, what are you talking about? And then he says, although external objects do not really exist, consciousness does truly exist. Therefore, since the images of objects which appear to consciousness are the mind itself, the true mind itself, they are suitable to be referred to. In other words, the reality of my mind that produces the illusion of external objects impart something of its reality to the objects so I can talk about them as illusory. So I can still hang in with the two truth theory, two reality theory. Even though my real reality, my mind is touching and part of the real reality. And it's still my mind. Right? So that means when you become Buddha, that's why I jumped up on Berzin when someone asked me about Berzin's, read me Berzin's sentence about there's no collective thing. And because, you know, the idea that, oh, it's my Buddhahood, you know, nobody else's Buddhahood. It's not correct. It's every Buddha's Buddhahood. And it's even every non-Buddha's Buddhahood. Which to them is called a Buddha nature because they're not conscious of their own deeper knowledge, which is their oneness with Buddha mind. If Buddha experiences himself as one with Bob Thurman, poor guy, if he does, then, and I don't, and I think, give me a break, I'm not Shakyamuni, but I'm Bob Thurman. You know, so I wish I saw Shakyamuni, but I don't, I just see statues. And who's more correct, me or him? Obviously he's Buddha, he's the correct one. I'm incorrect. So I don't know my. So the oneness that he knows is the real is my reality, but I don't know it. And then he knows I don't know it, and he's working on it. I'm a tough case. Well, that's what Shantideva's the one who's presenting the consequentialist view, the no-view view. But, and even he is being responsibly asserting that the no-view view is a relative view, just not an absolute view. It's wrong to say that the no-view view... Tsongkhapa in his... Actually, a work that you won't hear about around here, but my translation of Tsongkhapa's Essence of True Eloquence, or the Central Philosophy of Tibet, it's called, he deals with that, and he says that there are some people who think they have the high centrist, consequentialist, or I call it dialecticist view, is that I'm not really even here arguing with you. You just think I am. They say stuff like that. But that's not philosophically honest. You know, the person is there as an illusory being, arguing with these other illusory beings, and they just know more deeply that they're illusory than the other one. So they're more dealing with the other one's knots of confusion, and their views they're holding are more interactive with the other one. And they even appreciate the view that the other one holds. And therefore, they're able to help them release them from their thing. They're very compassionate and good. The dialecticists, that they're dialectical. They're dialogical, something like that. But they also are there. They're there for the other person. They're not there. That would then be dishonest. But they, you know, the thing is, when you have if you have a view and you're debating someone, and you know how people get when they debate, they get this ego thing of yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And they're no longer seeking truth through the debate. Then if they feel the reason that the Chantideva type level person will say I have no view is that they want to exemplify being open to the guy who's stuck on his view. But then the other guy said, oh, well, you're a nihilist then. You're not even there. And you know, then you're stuck on not having a no view view. He says, no, I have a view, which is no view view. It's very, very wonderful. It is. But anyway, let's stick on this point. He's just getting to this idea that he says, if illusion like external objects are not real for you, what can be referred to? Then he says, well, they don't, but consciousness truly exists. That's the key point. In other words, what's called objective selflessness is defined by the idealist as the lack of any substantial subject-object dichotomy. That's how they define it. When you experience the lack of a substantial subject-object dichotomy, you have realized objective selflessness, which means shunyata, emptiness. But somehow there's still a real mind of yours that experiences emptiness, so you have a real experience. So you kind of exclude some place of experience as non-relational, and yet you have it. And that's where you get stuck, according to the consequentialist, the dialecticist, centrist, the relativist. That blocks you from true, non-dual, emptiness relativity. And, you know, allows that little bit of self-assertion that put you in the impossible situation of you being something different from everything else that makes you suffer. So you're that tiny step short of freedom because you're not fully open. And therefore your compassion is restricted. If the mind itself, then the centrist says here, if the mind itself and the illusion-like objects are one substance, that is a mental substance, there, in other words, the centrist is trying to show to the idealist that they're creating a kind of pseudo-substance of mind. Then since there would be no beholder and no beheld, what object would be beheld by what mind? In other words, how would the illusion ever even arise? It has been said by the protector of the world himself that the mind, I don't like that, but the savior of the world himself. There's a special kind of word that, protector of the world himself, that the mind does not have the ability to behold the mind. Just as the blade of a sword cannot cut itself, likewise the mind cannot behold itself. So here he's trying to release the idealist from the idea that there's this some vestige of substantialist intrinsically real, intrinsically identifiable, intrinsically referential awareness at the depth of their consciousness, kind of a world-creating consciousness. Maybe he's saying the mind cannot behold itself. But then the idealist comes back with saying, well, a light completely illuminates itself in the same way that the mind knows itself. Okay, you switch on a light, and you say, well, the light not only shines in the room, it illuminates itself. As he thinks that's a metaphor for his self-awareness, his reflexive cognition that automatically happens. Kant called it apperception, A-P-P-E-P-E-R, apperception, meaning that a perception simultaneously perceives itself perceiving to avoid infinite regress. You know, then the centrist says, the light does not illuminate itself because something that is to be illuminated has to first of all be unilluminated. But as soon as the light is lit, it is never obscured by any darkness. That is to say, they get into this thing about light and darkness never contact each other. Because where there's light, there's no darkness. Where there's darkness, there's no light. So somehow they never make contact. So you can't say that light illuminates itself. That's just, you're just repeating, it's just like going light, light. You're just repeating the word. It's not happening. And that's an analytic thing. It's like, you know, if you say light causes darkness to disappear, where does it touch the darkness to cause it to disappear? Is it happen simultaneously? That means that the cause and the effect exist simultaneously, then the effect already pre-existed the cause. So for them to touch light and dark, the light and dark have to both coexist at the same instant. But if that's so, then light has not caused the darkness' disappearance, because light is already there, and darkness is still there. So it didn't get rid of it. In other words, just take it in your mind, and you will realize that the picture we have, sort of light kind of pushes away darkness, is a wrong picture. And in our concepts, light is the cause of the elimination of darkness. But when you try to put your concepts into the thing, it doesn't work that way. Similarly, if you have a bulb filament with electricity, is the filament lit? Does the filament disappear? You don't see that the filament stuck there in the light, obstructing light. The filament is still there as an obstacle to the light. I mean, you know, you can try all different ways, but the whole kind of analytic meditation is the kind of meditation where you look at processes of causation that we take for granted fit with our stories about them, our narrative of them, causal narrative of them, and we find that the picture will never quite fit the process because there's no sort of point where suddenly a causal thing suddenly, like the seed suddenly becomes a sprout. There's no exact instant. Where is the exact instant? It's like the line between your nose and your cheek